Blog Talk Radio.
Found it. You found it. The new, revised, updated, amazing Radio Free Mason. Needed to polish up the old format, I thought. Needed to reinvigorate the little gray cells. So what do? We have entertainment, information, enlightenment, a bit of music that I think will set the tone and atmosphere. I think an interesting storyline for today's show that I hope you'll like. This is the 20th of July, 2014, 201st day of the year. Only leaves us with 164 days left till New Year's Eve, so get your party hats and tutors ready. It's week 29. July 20th of the Georgian calendar. I was wondering about, Gregorian, not Georgian, the Gregorian calendar. Mistake a lot of people make, calling it the Georgian calendar. It replaced the Julian, and it dropped, Canada adopted this same year as the United Kingdom and the United States adopted it the same year Canada did in 1752. It's not as, the Julian was okay, but it wasn't very accurate. It had a calculation that one every 4 years was a leap year, so we had February 29th. But that wasn't the Gregorian calculates leap year, but it's not quite that simplistic. It has to do with a bit of a mathematic equation. Anyway, it's not perfect either. But it's only off one day every 3,236 years. So I guess in the meantime, we can live with that. We can live with that. it seems entirely tolerable. I don't wake up in the morning thinking, oh, geez, I'm out that millisecond over 3,236 years. It's not bad. For the OCDs in the crowd, you can, start your counting and touching and cleaning and whatever else other kind of ritualist behavior you have to do to try and reconstruct the balance you need to get through the day. Anyway, going to talk to you and ask for your advice again. Always in need of your advice. But you ever wondered why there's so many opinions in Freemasonry? We would want to, in an ideal world, when we ask ourselves what this is about and to go about our business, we would, I think, want something definitive, a tome, one central thesis, you know. We could read it, and it would be compelling and informative and descriptive. Freemasonry, we don't have that. I think that's part of the work of Freemasonry, the task that's taken on, and I think that's primarily at an operation level. It's a duty, a responsibility, or a task with some purpose in mind, some goal. And the lessons are, you know, the work of it is part of the lesson, the work to achieve that goal. And we have a great deal of metaphor that carries that message forward. But you must have wondered why so many opinion pieces, you know, over the years, and it's going to explode. We've had the luxury of coming from a time when a lot of material wasn't written down. A nice luxury, and I'll explain that. Can you imagine if everybody in the 17th and 18th and 19th century was writing, producing as much material as we are today? Can you imagine what that would feel like? How many millions of articles and millions of books there would be sitting there waiting, sitting on the shelf waiting, and then barring some catastrophe like the, you know, everyone's burning the libraries or something like that. That's not likely to happen again. That we would have to plunge into that material. And today, you know, everything has gone sideways. The timeline moving on as it does, forward and backward. We've begun to explain what time is and trying to understand it. And we're finding that's an uncommon task, isn't it? The past, present, and future occurring in the moment. The past always with us, spatially. Look at the physicists helping us understand the creation in a whole different way. That is posing more questions, raising more questions. And so the search for answers will continue. And as it should. But the work of this, I think, I've noticed some things, and I'd like to share it with you, is that Freemasonry isn't an entity. It's a way of characterizing you. It's a way of speaking to your intellect, to your emotion, to your history, to your aspirations, to your function in everyday life. It is of you, or if you want to be a little more generous, of us. Put aside the bumper sticker, good man, better. Put that aside. No offense. I mean no offense to those who cling to those five words, six words. I think the most beautiful equations are the simple equations. I don't have that kind of intelligence that some people do. So I still think a little more, my thinking is still a bit more clumsy than yours, I presume. But the work defined is not about a Grand Lodge organization. When you think about it, in a more natural, just come with me through time. In a natural state of mind, here we were, some people, some men or women, we don't know, talking about meaning and understanding, raising questions, not probing all of the deeper questions, not all at once, and not having all of the reference material at the fingertips that we do today,
but pondering essential, and I think of them as natural questions for thoughtful people. People who were just as we are today, our students who are well organized to be observant and descriptive and understanding, as we always have been. But in answering those, they weren't encumbered by ponderous, large operations. And perhaps I'm wrong here, but I tend to think over the years we have accumulated committees, boards, committee structures, lines of accountability and governance and finance. And the organizations, the means, in other words, the structures, have become for many the message. And I think it's obscured what Freemasonry is. Freemasonry is not an organizational structure. And you've heard me talk about how important a Grand Lodge is to preserve what we have. So make no mistake, if you take that gnarly thin finger that you're wagging in my face and put it back in your pocket for a second, friend. I don't mean that. I'm talking about the relationship of how we relate in our own thinking to the ideas of Freemasonry. And Freemasonry, if we're believing it, if you're one, and I'm not one, if you're a person that thinks that the pinnacle of Freemasonry occurred in the past, then bear with me that it began before there was structure and before 1717, which is coming up to 300-year anniversary. But these ideas existed well before that, and that's documented. There's not conjecture. You know, there's wonderful debate. You know, we want to be first off the line. Well, in Scotland, what do we have? Four firsts. You know, Canada, we have the oldest is number two, but where's number one? Well, a little bit of history to find out where number one and what was number one and how do you calculate it. Well, it's really a matter of once you notice something, then you can begin to measure it, can't you? Well, if you didn't notice, you just said, well, good bunch of fellows over in that community, and they're Freemason Masonic Lodge, and over there in Niagara, and there's another bunch, and down in Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, you know. There must have been a time when it didn't matter who was first. Just the fact that it existed was enormous. And I think today it still doesn't matter that greatly in the scope of things who was first. The fact is that what matters, it exists in a very beautiful form. So unencumbered, we had these ideas. And through discussion and debate, friendly debate back and forth, we began to sort out certain truths and facts to support those truths. And we began to realize that the opinions we wanted to, in order to achieve these truths and facts, we had to elicit opinion. You couldn't have somebody shying away and self-conscious about offering an opinion, because that way we would never know the person's thoughts, and that would block their path toward understanding in a lot of cases. I don't say that discussion is the path, but it would block discussion and communication, even within your own mind. So the processes over the centuries have unfolded and grown, and I think in some ways created, and I'll agree with our brother, Worshipful Brother Hammer, in this respect, that there have been distractions. I don't agree that appended orders have been distracting us from the essence of craft masonry. I don't agree with this thesis now. It's interesting. I love the way he writes. He's so supportive and clean in his writing. But the work is has become, I use the word ponderous. You can easily see then how we would begin to think that Freemasonry is a philanthropic organization, because that's in Canada particularly, that's where we put a lot of our energy. And you think that, and here I'm going to predict, you come back and haunt me in 100 years. We are at the end of a beginning, and the beginning of another phase, the second epoch. We have our house in order, so to speak. Don't get me started that we don't have our own lodge room. That will come. Trust me, brethren, it will come one day, because it's necessary. The symbol of permanence will come. Not permanence, but the symbol of it. One day. But to think about how well we've done, how pleased we should be with the efforts of our financial efforts to support students and research. 50 years ago in Ontario, there was a recognition that they really needed to give people that were trained the responsibility for financial development and management. And look at how, is it amazing? Not when you consider the talent, but what was really foresighted was a Grand Lodge that understood that they had expectations that weren't being met. And so what did they do? They put the resource, the commitment, the resource and the energy into making it happen. And we can be we should be pleased with the effort generation by generation. And it's still not stopping. It's still growing. And I say this to you, the second epoch of Freemasonry is occurring now, having to do with education, because we put our head up. And this is, I think, a uniquely Canadian perspective. We don't have the lengthy history of Britain or Greece or Turkey or Mesopotamia or the Germanic states or Netherlands, or, you know, we don't. We are much younger and fresher. And so we're creating, in a sense, our history certainly comes from our environment. We don't measure our history in decades, but in millions of years. The granite shields, quartz, and forests, and Great Lakes, and ice ages. This is a history of Canada. Lately, it's been a history of the people of the country, the nation. But all of that aside, now when the energy, we're going to see a matching. We're now realizing and looking for, and the questions are coming through the door, brought on by the bottom following out. You know, that bottom following out, we still find apologists for that. You know, our membership numbers, I don't want to get into that. That's just too distracting for some. But it's telling us something. Well, that's giving us reason to pause and say, oh, well, what else isn't happening? Well, what else isn't happening is the enrichment, the enrichment of the mind through education. And now I think we're seeing an improvement, a willingness, a commitment to improve the experience, quality improvement, if you want to call it that. That's sort of a popular buzzword these days. The improving the experience of Freemasonry, philosophically, ethically, and we're creating lots of vehicles for that to happen. The most beautiful of all is the fact that these discussions are going on all over the place. People are, men, good fellows, new and old, are sharpening their pencils. And it's not something startling or criticism, anything like that. Get over that. Get over yourself, criticism. This is really just a reality check. what do we need to do? Well, the next thing, now that we've got our house in order, foundation is strong, we're going to put up a structure. And we're going to start with a temple of the mind. Start, we come full circle. Beautiful. It's beautiful. So that's what I think is happening. That's what I predict is happening around us now. It took all those generations to help us get here. So we're standing on the shoulders of masons that have lived before us, done whatever they've done without any value judgment. They've done what they've done. And their small part, or at whatever molecular level they have performed a task, they've helped us to get where we are today. And now we're able to expand mind, expand the thinking. So pull up your comfortable chair and pour yourself a glass of something that is right for the moment. And let me attempt here to inject some ideas and information of, that bring a quality and some thinking, Masonic thinking to the day. And hopefully we'll have stepped into that second epoch and together and being stronger for the experience. So you see, you are truly Freemasonry. And if that's not easy to get your head around, well, welcome to the human race. If it presents you with the task, what do I do now? Well, if you're a selfish sod, you have figured out that you don't have to do anything. You can live the complete indolent sponge parasitic life. And you can pretend. But when you look in the mirror, you examine your own conscience, you know the truth about yourself. And that's what Freemasonry attempts to adjust, to help us to be more generous with ourselves. Charity. Charity does begin at home. You have to be charitable in the way that you look at yourself. If you can't do that, you certainly are faking it with everyone else around you. Be charitable with about your history and with your spirit. Be charitable about your abilities, and particularly about your faults. As you know, we're not children. As we go through life, we become grown men. I love people that tell me that pretend that they don't have any misgivings about their life. No regret. I have no regrets. It's not. I don't expect people to tell me what their regrets are. That's embarrassing. That's personal. Somebody laying claim to that. There we come again, huh? A life unexamined is not worth living. You just keep telling yourself you have no regrets. Just keep believing that as long as you can. When you get over that, then ask yourself what comes next. And that's the light shining in the east, isn't it? That's Sirius in the Egyptian sky signaling the cycles of the Nile. This is the reconciliation of the origins of Masonic Companion to bring thoughtful Masonic discourse to Freemasons wherever you are and the future. Reconciliation about where you are and the future. For those of out there over the age of 35, you will recognize the homage to Radio Free Europe penetrating the borders and ethos with examination of ideas. Radio Freemasonry. There is much about craft masonry that is not understood. Society and science evolved across Europe and Britain. The execution of the man King Charles left a curious vacuum in leadership. History has not been kind to Cromwell. People seem to realize monarchy defined the nation. Nor did deference to the French king stop revolution in the 18th century. The church no longer determined truth. Scientists, philosophers had the protection they needed to reinforce humanism. Now, 21st century free men are plagued by the children of 19th century Darwinian theory, terribly distorted, misquoted, and confused to make it fit racist and imperialist interests. Herbert Spencer pulled apart Darwin's theory to give us a simplistic, incomplete version still popular today. Social Darwinism and survival of the fittest is what he called it. We can't help but notice this is the basis of capitalism, survival being most important because the alternative is extinction. An interesting economic experiment that has failed to produce trickle-down but has left the world witnessing the stagnation of former world power brokers. How can we claim thoughts and events influenced by that thinking have no effect on the world of Freemasonry? I refuse to accept that Freemasonry espouses escapism when the landmarks are dominantly about common good. How do we know a Freemason is a Freemason? Can we possibly answer that question without being objective? A little music wouldn't kill us, would it? Just a taste. Summer. Ha ha. A little bit of Vivaldi for the morning. A little bit, not too much. We've been celebrating or the gathering, the annual gathering of Freemasonry here in this location. Congratulations to all of the elected and appointed who will carry on the work of the organization and the function. We can study the opinions of other people to help us develop our own. When you're hearing something on here, I'd like you to think, you know, listen to the piece and think about what it means, what the information means, but then think about what you take away from it. What does it say to you? It may say nothing. It may say volumes. It may stimulate your thinking. Don't take things, I don't only say to you, try not to take things literally as they're written without examining them. Is it accurate? Is it saying something? Or is it just wordsmithing that has, you know, beautiful phrases? I'll talk to you about the happiness that is inherent to Freemasonry. But referring to some people much more well known than me, how about Epictetus, the Greek? The Greek philosopher. Happiness and freedom begin with a clear understanding of one principle, he says. Some things are within your control, and some things are not. Figure it out. If this is about making you a better person, then isn't that a lesson you need to put into practice and not just keep in your mind? Living a good life isn't knowing, it's doing. You don't do unless you have some clue what's going on. Head in sand doesn't really work. But he went on to say all philosophy lies in just two words, sustain and abstain. So happiness and freedom, if you're looking for happiness in life, this is telling us, I think, that it's odd, or that we really haven't, man doesn't have much control over his emotion. If he's getting upset about the things he has no control over, means that we pull our egos back into scale so that it fits and back into our pocket. So we're not walking around saying everything that we do in our life is in our control. Don't mistake being responsible for your actions with control. And when you look at somebody who is greatly disadvantaged, and you're assuming some level of piety because you are not there but for the grace of God, we cannot control our tomorrow. We make the best of what we have around us. But that happiness, that comes from understanding. That doesn't come from something external. I can't buy your happiness. Euripides said, there is one thing alone that stands the brunt of life throughout its course. How do you tolerate the brunt? You know, the pressure, the seriousness of life. He said the answer to that is a quiet conscience. Walk around beating yourself up? I'm not talking about some psychopath that doesn't have one. doesn't have a conscience, can act without thinking about the effect of his actions on other people. I'm not talking about that. That's a person that's damaged. That's damaged. And it's not right to mock people that are damaged like that. We have places where we can keep them safe and keep us safe and take care of them. There is one thing alone that stands at the brunt of life throughout its course, a quiet conscience. We have to be at peace with ourselves. Sometimes you walls up not to the... He who is unable to live in society or who has no need because he is sufficient for himself must be either a beast or a god. Well, yeah. Brilliant. As Socrates would tell you, my advice to you is get married. If you find a good wife, you'll be happy. If not, you'll become a philosopher. No. What did he know? I'm only saying. He said he hadn't lost his mind, though. Maybe he's understanding some things that only... as you get older, you could admit to yourself, I only wish that ordinary people had an unlimited capacity for doing harm. I only wish that ordinary people had an unlimited capacity for doing harm. Then they might have an unlimited power for doing good. And I'll go on and talk about some of the symbols of Freemasonry today. But I'll leave you with this right now. This is from Pythagoras, you know, the Kabbalah school. This number is the ruler of forms and ideas and the cause of gods and demons. Pythagoras, we have got to have a drink and sort out. Man, it's a little deep, don't you think? Don't you think? My goodness. Well, I'm going to talk. We'll come back to that. Makes you think, doesn't it? Makes you think a little bit. We need to be in the mood, don't we? A little bit of a mood for this. There's a little something that I found that I think you'll find interesting. This is from music that was that was written for the cartoon called Fantasia. And it's a fairy tale. And it's about an apprentice who was learning to some of the powers of he was an apprentice to a sorcerer, and the sorcerer taught him certain magic, and he had to carry, one of his tasks was to carry buckets of water. You all remember this. And so he thought that if he used magic, the job could be done much easier, much, much easier. What he forgot was how to control it. Was how to control the magic. And it got out of control, didn't it? Yeah. We'll We'll come back and talk a bit. Listen to this and see what you think. And tell me. Tell me your things and thoughts on it. When we were, it's a way that Walt Disney presented classical music to children everywhere that may not have had the opportunity, children and adults. Because of their circumstance, they may not have been exposed to classical music. In a way, we used to think that exposure to different forms of music when you were younger allowed you to develop those appetites, much the same as, you know, we hear mothers trying to introducing different types of flavors to their children at an early age. So as they age, they'll be able to enjoy different flavors. The thinking was that, you know, there's enjoyment in foods from different cultures, and some folks have never developed the palate. It's not like you. I mean, you know that if you're a wine, if you like a good glass of wine, developing your palate, or a good glass of whiskey. When I was a young man, I wouldn't have liked scotch, but as I grew older, I started to, it's something that I had heard about, acquired tastes. And I had no idea what it was until I actually attempted it. And my goodness, glad that I did. But you can do that with flavors. You can do that with lifestyles. You can also do it with music. I'm a boy from Cavendish. Son of... grandson and great-grandson and great-great-grandson of blacksmiths and farmers and fishermen. That was classical music. We heard the fiddle. Eh? That's tradition in that area. I was brought up here in Ontario. The music of the period was country. Not country and western, but country. soulful, mournful music of the people. And it was only when I was able to, search, took opportunities to learn that I was exposed to this world of ideas. It just opened. And part of that were things that at the time I found very unusual. But I had an opportunity to sit without being judged and listen. And I began to realize, it's like when you try something, you're not sure if you like it, and then you realize that you do. Well, that's how I slid gradually into listening to opera and listening to classical music and jazz. Working in Detroit and finding WJZZ. You could actually listen to jazz early in the morning. I never had that 24-hour-a-day jazz station. Turns your head. Why music? Why music? Well, if music be the food of love, play on, give me access of it. And if not, well, what exactly is it for? The production and consumption of music is a big part of the economy. The first use to which commercial recording in the form of Edison's phonographs was to bring music to the living rooms and picnic tables of those who could not afford to pay live musicians. Today, people are so surrounded by other people's music that they take it for granted. But as little as 100 years ago, sing songs at home, the choir in the church, and fiddlers in the pub were all that most people heard. Other appetites, too, have been sated even to excess by modern business. Food, far beyond the simple needs of stomachs, bombard the modern man and woman and are eagerly consumed. But these excesses are built on obvious appetites. What appetite drives the proliferation of music to the point where the average American teenager spends 1.5 to 2.5 hours a day, an eighth of his waking life, listening to it? Well, that fact that he or she is young supports one hypothesis about the function of music. Around 40% of the lyrics of popular songs speak of romance, sexual relations, and sexual behavior. The Shakespearean theory that music is at least one of the foods of love has a strong claim to be true. The more mellifluous the singer, the more dexterous the harpist, the more mates he attracts. A second idea that is widely touted is that music binds groups of people together. The resulting solidarity, its supporters suggest, may have helped bands of early humans to thrive at the expense of those who were less musical. Both of these ideas argue that musical ability evolved specifically, that is, if you like, a virtual organ as precisely crafted to its purpose as the heart or the spleen. The third hypothesis, however, is that music is a cross between an accident and an intervention. It is an accident because it is the consequence of abilities that evolved for other purposes. And it is an intervention because, having thus come into existence, people have bent it to their will and made something they like from it. At the opening, Shakespeare's famous quote was, of course, based on commonplace observation. Singing well done is certainly sexy. But is its sexiness the reason it exists? Charles Darwin thought so. 12 years after he published On the Origin of Species, which prescribed the idea of natural selection, a second book hit the presses, The Descent of Man and Selection in Relation to Sex, suggested that the need to find a mate being the pressing requirement that it is, a lot of the features of any given animal have come about not to aid its survival, but to aid its courtship. The most famous example is the tale of the peacock. But Darwin suggested human features, too, might be sexually selected in this way, and one of those he lit on was music. In this case, unlike that of natural selection, Darwin's thinking did not set the world alight. But his ideas were recently revived by Jeffrey Miller, an evolutionary biologist who works at the University of New Mexico. Dr. Miller starts with the observations that music is a human universal, that it is costly in terms of time and energy to produce, and that is, at least in some sense, under genetic control. About 4% of the population has amusia, A-M-U-S-I-A, of one sort or another, and at least some types of amusia are known to be heritable.
Universality, costliness, and genetic control all suggest that music has a clear function in survival and reproduction. And Dr. Miller plumps for reproduction. One reason for believing this is that musical productivity, at least among the recording artists who have exploited the phonograph and its successors over the past 100 years, seems to match the course of an individual's reproductive life. In particular, Dr. Miller studied jazz musicians. He found that their output rises rapidly after puberty, reaches its peak during young adulthood, and then declines with age and the demands of parenthood. As is often the case with this sort of observation, it sounds unremarkable, obvious even, but uniquely human activities associated with survival, cooking, say, do not show this pattern. People continue to cook at about the same rate from the moment they have mastered the art until the moment they die or are too decrepit to continue. Moreover, the anecdotal evidence linking music to sexual success is strong. Dr. Miller often cites the example of Jimi Hendrix, who had sex with hundreds of groupies during his brief life, and though he was legally unmarried, maintained 2 long liaisons. The words of Robert Plant, the lead singer of Led Zeppelin, are also permanent. I was always on my way to love, always. Whatever road I took, the car was heading for one of the greatest sexual encounters I ever had. Another reason to believe the food of love hypothesis is that music fulfills the main criteria of a sexually selected feature. It is an honest signal of underlying fitness. Just as unfit peacocks cannot grow splendid tails, so unfit people cannot sing well or dance well or play music well. All of these activities require physical fitness and dexterity. Composing music requires creativity and mental agility. Put all of these together and you have a desirable mate. A third reason to believe it is that music or something very like it has evolved in other species and seems to be sexually selected in those species too. Just as the parallel evolution of mouse-like forms in marsupial and placental animals speaks of similar ways of life, so the parallel evolution of songs in birds, whales, and gibbons, as well as humans, speaks of a similar underlying function. And females of these animals can be fussy listeners. It is known for several species of birds, for example, that females prefer more complex songs from their suitors, putting males under pressure to evolve the neurological apparatus to create and sing them. And yet, though Dr. Miller's arguments are convincing, they do not feel like the whole story. A man does not have to be gay to enjoy the music of an all-male orchestra, even if he particularly appreciates the soprano who comes on to sing the solos. A woman, meanwhile, can enjoy the soprano even while appreciating the orchestra on more than one level. Something else besides sex seems to be going on. The second hypothesis for music's emergence is that it had a role not just in helping humans assess their mates, but also in binding bands of people together in the evolutionary past. Certainly, it sometimes plays that role today. It may be unfashionable in Britain to stand for the national anthem, but 2 minutes watching the last night of the proms, an annual music festival on television, will serve to dispel any doubts about the ability of certain sorts of music to instill collective purpose in a group of individuals. In this case, the cost in time and energy is assumed to be repaid in some way by the advantages of being part of a successful group. The problem with this hypothesis is that it relies on people not cheating and taking the benefits without paying the costs. One way out of that dilemma is to invoke a phenomenon known to biologists as group selection. Biologically, this is a radical idea. It requires the benefits of solidarity to be so great that groups lacking them are often extinguished en bloc. Though theoretically possible, this is likely to be rare in practice. However, some researchers have suggested that the invention of weapons such as spears and bows and arrows made intertribal warfare among early humans so lethal that group selection did take over. It has been invoked, for example, to explain the contradictory manifestations of morality displayed in battle: tenderness towards one's own side, ruthlessness towards the enemy. In this context, the martial appeal of some sorts of music may make sense. Robin Dunbar of Oxford University does not go quite that far, but unlike Miller, he thinks that the origins of music need to be sought in social benefits of group living rather than the sexual benefits of seduction. He does not deny that music has gone on to be sexually selected, but he does not think it started that way. Dunbar thinks language evolved to fill the role of grooming as human tribes grew too large for everyone to be able to groom everyone else. This is a controversial hypothesis, but it is certainly plausible. The evidence suggests, however, that the needs of such remote grooming would arise when a group exceeds about 80 individuals, whereas human language really got going when group sizes had risen to around 140. It's a very small group, when you think. His latest idea is that the gap was bridged by music, which may thus be seen as a precursor of language. Like cheesecake, music sates an appetite that nature cannot. If you listen to music, there is a volume level that produces an emotional response. I mean, try it. 50 decibels. Try it. We don't gain the emotional response at a quieter music. But try listening to your music. That's like standing near a live jazz band or country music. You know, you're getting a very loud production of song and drum and string and horn. Try it. 50 decibel elicits emotional response. But that's the point. I feel the need to, you know, explain a little bit about the point of having music in this. It didn't make sense to me that Freemasonry, the music has died. I don't think it has. I just think it was lost. Now, I'm going to talk to you just today. We're going to talk just a little bit about a symbol, a little more music, and then we're gone. And I'll look forward to hearing from you again. If you want to comment about it, I've got a chat line open on here. If you're live, if you're listening to this live at the crack of dawn. If not, I won't be able to keep that line open all the time. The image of the point within the circle. I want to talk to you about that point within the circle. Now think of this. Just draw a little tiny circle and put a dot in the middle of it, and then put two parallel lines, one on each side of it. The image of the point within the circle, bounded by two perpendicular staves, is one of the most intriguing symbols, if that's what it is, in Masonic tradition. Now, I'm coming at this from the work of somebody that a writer that I greatly admire, Tobias Chertib. You've heard me talk about his work before. The Royal Arch magazine, fairly good magazine in Britain, refers to him as the authority on Masonic history. It's pretty good. And you can pick this his book up, Freemasonry, The Reality, if you want to round out those stories about the myths and legends. This is the kind of thing that might be very interesting for you. No one today can be certain of what was originally intended by the point within the circle and the two staves. It was obviously important for some people. For obscure as it first appears, there has been no willingness to let it go. It is now mostly seen, if it is noticed, inscribed on the table or lectern on which the volume of the sacred law is opened, in the first degree tracing board. Thus, it seems to support the three great legs of Masonry. What can it mean? First, it encodes the method whereby a circle may be squared. Suspend a plumb line the length of the radius of the circle from the extreme right and left of that circle. Join the ends of the two lines by a straight line. You have thus created two perfect squares. Thus, one can demonstrate that the square, which traditionally represents earthbound measurement, is derived from the circle, which describes, like the compass, celestial movement, the sun, stars, and moon. If in squaring the circle you have unified both material and heavenly or spiritual dimensions and shown the former's dependence on the latter. The demonstration shows practical and symbolic Freemasonry as one process. Whoa! I should add that there are other interpretations, some symbolic and mystical. For example, as the circle is the perfect figure, having neither beginning nor end, wherein all its degrees are equidistant from its center, so it represents eternity expressed, or the pure creative act. Fiat lux. Let there be light. Circular motion was held in classical times to be perfect motion, though this cannot be said to be true as regards all our buses. It's a joke. The material dimensions represented by the two staves or lines on each side of the circle is the constraint of that perfection in a dualistic system, that is, the cosmos. The Almighty has constrained itself in order to create the square world, the word of the four elements. This idea has resonance in Lurianic Kabbalah. Kabbalah is a form of Jewish mysticism or Gnosis tradition that hopes to show the divine character in man and in the universe, a secret insight. Lurianic Kabbalah, or Kabbalah, tries to explain the limitations of the universe as being a result of the contradiction in the being of God, whereby the supreme principle of being makes a space within his being, from which he, in a sense, withdraws. This interpretation is only one of any number of interesting speculations, but it does not seem to this to be what was originally intended. Indeed, the simplest explanation for the symbol is that it simply shows the principle of drawing the foundation line for a circular structure. To do this, the builder can employ a point in a center in which one staff is placed, while another staff is extended on a line to its limit. Thus, the mason describes the outlying circle in the dust. The two men performing the task of two points of a compass, the two operators becoming, as it were, one. The staves could then have come to be associated with the two wardens, or the master and his warden, each holding a staff. Nowadays, the wardens may carry wands. The point in this center was probably used to illustrate the third degree, teaching wherein the master mason cannot err when he is at the center of the circle. This has, again, a purely practical and a spiritual meaning. At the center, or point, is both God, the point from which time and space derives, and the heart of the mason, wherein his conscience is pricked and where the spirit of God and his eternal love is to be found. There are alchemical implications too. In alchemy, the symbol of the sun is the circle with a point at its center. In Freemasonry, the master is associated with the sun, and the sun, of course, is the source of light. The sun is also mystically and philosophically the source of enlightenment. The jewel, the sun, rests on him, the master, first. Esoteric speculation regarding the point in the circle can be found in a book by John Dee, the famous Elizabethan astrologer and mathematician. It's called Monus Hieroglyphica, and it was printed in 1564, a book on the unity of the cosmos. Dee hoped it would be read and eventually applied by practical men. The book is very hard to understand, blending as it does Kabbalah, alchemy, mathematics, and philosophy. Interesting guy to have a drink with, huh, John? In fact, it was a visionary work, and Dee probably tried to veil what he was really getting at, as he seemed to think he was onto something so important, he could only hint at its real meaning. Unfortunately, he is no longer available for interrogation. We must get by with hints, inferences, and allusions. But it is worth mentioning that the book was much appreciated by persons attracted to the early 17th century Rosicrucian version of global reform, with which Freemasonry has often been linked. One thing at least is clear. Dee saw a profound connection between alchemy, architecture, and indeed all the arts and sciences. His one hieroglyph was a magical attempt to symbolize and encompass this unity. Dee's intriguing figure is based on the circle with the point at its center, joined to the alchemical symbol for Mercury, together with two semicircles. In fact, the symbol would be geometrically constructed from the circle with the point at its center, together with two staves, as we see in the tracing board. This implies that whether the Freemason knew it or not, they had the universe at their fingertips. It seems possible that some such insight had somehow got into 18th century Freemasonry, but nobody can be sure how or what it might mean. There's a longer popular Masonic teaching that the two staves or lines represent John the Baptist and John the Evangelist, respectively. Their days are close to the solstices and were occasions for Masonic feasts, the 24th of June for the Baptist and the 27th of December for the Evangelist. The role of the two Johns may be identified as one, is one of the fascinating, unexplained mysteries of Masonic tradition. That does not mean, of course, that nobody has tried to explain it. Sometime after the Union in 1813, Freemasonry was encouraged to become non-denominational, and its most obviously Christian elements were removed. The Johns were changed to Moses and King Solomon, law and wisdom. Enough. You get the idea? Thank you. That serves a purpose. Now, here's a song I think you'll... Here's a bit of music that I think... I won't play it all. This is from Rimsky-Korsakov. Just a little taste to set up the next article, and then we'll head out the door. That's a night on Bald Mountain. Rimsky-Korsakov. Relax. Relax a little bit. You know, that was arranged by Rimsky-Korsakov. It's written by Mussorgsky. Man, it was performed a little bit around 1867. And later, another version came up about 1886. And it's very popular for orchestras to do that piece. But we soon have to go. Practice of Freemasonry is philosophical. It doesn't mean you have to have a philosophy and go out and act. This isn't like a Arthur Murray, a dance studio where you put, you know, footprints on the floor and you step into the line. You may and probably are functioning in a philosophical frame of reference without necessarily knowing or doing it because you have read about it. But when you read different philosophies, you begin to understand more about yourself. I'm going to just give you a bit of samples about the Golden Rule. This is something I think that is really important, and I believe symbolically it shows up in some of the old tracing boards that we see. It's like the beehive. That was a symbol that was sort of faded in time. But you look at some of the early references and artifacts, and we see the beehive represented. So this is something that I think permeates. It does permeate the major religions of the world. The Golden Rule, one that we were taught either in our church or synagogue or mosque or temple, but we picked it up through osmosis. Do unto others, the Golden Rule. But there's variations that are found not only in. The English playwright George Bernard Shaw said about the Golden Rule. He rewrote it and said, "Do not do unto others as you would have others do unto you. They may have different taste." In inflicting pain on others, the masochist is only doing what the Golden Rule requires, doing what he would like and done unto him, preferably with a whip. It's a little harsh, don't you think? Immanuel Kant's overarching principle, the criteria for all other ethical maxims, is what he calls the supreme categorical imperative. Work this one into your conversation. At first blush, this imperative merely sounds like a gussied up version of the Golden Rule. Do unto others as you would have. The supreme categorical imperative says, act only according to that maxim whereby you can, at the same time, will that it should become a universal law. Of course, Kant's rendition is a decidedly colder ring, but he couldn't help it. He was German. Hinduism says, 13th century, do not to others what ye do not wish done to yourself. This is the whole Dharma. Heed it well. Judaism, 13th century BC, says, what is hateful to you, do not do to your neighbor. That is the entire Torah. The rest is commentary. Go learn it. Zoroastrianism, 12th century BC. Human nature is good only when it does not do unto others whatever is not good for its own self. Buddhism, 6th century BC. Hurt not others in ways that you hurt yourself would find hurtful. Confucianism from 6th century BC. Do not do to others what you would not want done to yourself. Islam, 7th century AD. No one of you is a believer until you desire for another that which you desire for yourself. Baha'i, 19th century AD. Ascribe not to any soul that which thou wouldst not have ascribed to thee, and say not that which thou dost not. This is my command unto thee, do thou observe it. You ever notice the problem with German food is that no matter how much you eat, an hour later you're hungry for power. I don't get it. Come back and we'll talk sometime, eh? I'll leave you with this one. Aristotle said, quality is not an act. It is a habit. Socrates reminded, these things speak to me. I cannot teach anybody anything. I can only make them think. So if this modest little show has done anything, it's hopefully to make you think. I'll leave you with this tune. It's very nice too. Very, very nice piece. Yeah. I think you'll like it. I'll see you soon.
Wanted to once.